Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand.
I'm not voting for anybody for Congress who does not promise to support a bill of impeachment against George W. Bush if he's elected to Congress.
Strong words from Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild. Avery's speech in Chicago about the Guild's lawsuit against President Bush is coming up. But first, we turn to the immigration issue.
What do we want? When do we want it? What do we want?
Justice!
I can't hear you. What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
Get them all!
On May Day, hundreds of thousands of immigrants and their supporters crammed the streets of Chicago in a peaceful demonstration against immigration legislation in the U.S. Congress that would criminalize undocumented people in this country. The largely Mexican crowds shouted for justice for immigrants. To many, that means amnesty.
My name is Willie.
And why are you here?
We want an amnesty.
I'm here for support the cause for the immigration laws. Uh-huh.
What would you like to see?
Change in the laws, and the president to help us for legalization.
Yes, legalization for all my people. It would just give all these people an opportunity to have a job and be able to have a car, be able to, you know, have an insurance. You know, basically, it will bring them from the shadows, bring all these people from the shadows. This is what they need.
My name is Claudia. We came here to support our people. Yeah, we're not criminals. We're here to work.
What's your name?
Sandra.
Why did you come?
Because my people, he work.
It's no accident that immigrants chose May Day, International Workers' Day, for their demonstration, says Jorge Mujica, lead organizer with the March 10th Coalition, speaking on the eve of the march.
We pick and choose exactly May Day because we want to make this movement into a workers' movement. This is not about just papers. Having papers and being legal is not going to increase our wages, is not going to give us health insurance, is not going to give us, you know, the employer to pay us the overtime they owed us forever. So we have to go further than legalization. We have to organize into labor unions, fight for the right to organize, to strike, and to fight for our working conditions.
Mujica sees this as a continuation of struggles by largely immigrant workers who rallied 120 years ago in Chicago to secure the 8-hour working day. Indeed, the present immigration controversy is not new and hinges largely on labor issues. But what is absent from the dialogue in the mainstream media are the push and pull factors that have accelerated the rate of Mexican immigration in the last couple of decades. A new article by Richard Vogel, a writer for the Monthly Review, shows the dramatic rise in illegal immigration from Mexico since the passage of the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, in 1994. Vogel, a retired public high school teacher in Houston, where many of his students were Hispanic, explored the history of Mexican immigration in an article he wrote for the Houston Institute for Culture called Stolen Birthright, the U.S. Conquest and Exploitation of the Mexican People. Vogel says several U.S. programs have resulted in pushing Mexicans north in search of opportunity. NAFTA in the 90s, the U.S.-backed devaluation of the Mexican peso in the 80s, and in the 60s, a program nicknamed BIP, the Border Industrialization Program.
The Border Industrialization Program, which established the Maquiladora manufacturing belt, originally right around across the border. They were supposed to be twin cities. They were supposed to be linked, you know, a city in the United States linked with the city. So it'd be like Juarez and El Paso or Laredo and Nuevo Laredo. And the whole point was, and it was announced publicly by the U.S. Department of Labor, was to tap into cheap labor on the Mexican side. And the other thing, of course, was American industries could ship goods, like, well, they could ship things to be assembled in Mexico and then bring them back, and the value added would not be taxed. And the United States manufacturers would avoid any kind of responsibilities like schools to train workers and, you know, housing issues and taxation issues, because the Mexican government arranged that they could just get their goods, you know, and move them back across the border on the value added. Now, what happened were, when the American companies got over there, they immediately realized that what they could do is hire women labor cheaper than men, because that's just historical, you know. And so they were hiring women in the factories, and the men who were coming to the border towns who had been displaced by the programs you mentioned earlier, got to the maquiladoras and found out they weren't going to get hired. And they're looking across the border, and the Rio Grande is not that impressive down here. In fact, it dried up at the mouth here a few years ago. And just automatically went across the border because they couldn't go back to the south. There was nothing in their hometowns and in the Mexican cities. So they moved on across the border, and that was the big flood of male, single male immigrants that were showing up in the United States. And they also did not want to compete with women workers in the factory. Anyhow, none of us do. Women work too hard. They're too focused. So right away with the maquiladoras, it put pressure on, you know, illegal migrants coming into the United States immediately. Now, NAFTA, and, you know, that was good old President Clinton said that it was going to eradicate poverty in the South and equalize wages and everything. But that's not true because NAFTA duplicated what happened on the border, only took it deep into the interior of Mexico, but with the same results. And that was with pressure on the single males, push from at home, and then the pull of cheap jobs in the United States. And what I call a gatekeeper border policy, which is a porous border that allows people to come through, you know, and not be stopped. At one time I was a truck driver, and, you know, I had an opportunity when I went down to the border to cross into the border and bring back a truckload of workers for a big corporation here in Houston, Texas. And I chose not to take it because I didn't want, you know, to carry human cargo. So this has been going on for a long time. You know, NAFTA made it worse. And then the austerity programs imposed on Mexico by the United States, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the austerity programs also have driven, you know, farmers off the land and workers from government industries, because everything's been privatized, and loosened them up too. So we have the odd situation where even though the maquiladoras are the third largest source of income in Mexico, the actual wages for workers have gone down, especially since NAFTA, and the total number of jobs employed have gone down.
Now, President Bush says it's not practical to repatriate all these people, 12 million undocumented workers, back to Mexico. But there have been, and you write that there have been repatriation campaigns in the past. Can you tell me just a little bit about those?
Okay, historically, the first mass migration into the United States of Mexican workers was during World War I, when the manpower drainage in the United States created this massive shortage. You know, we had so many men overseas and all support group, and then all the industries in the Northeast and the Midwest supporting that. All the native farm boys left and went to the cities and took their families with them, you know. And if they weren't drafted, we're moving to get these jobs. And so the government of Mexico did their share for the American war effort by opening the gates and letting workers come across the border. The U.S. Border Patrol, which was originally set up to control Chinese labor, it was an open-door policy for years for Mexican labor. They just came and went. It was like an open door to Mexico. The Border Patrol was originally set up to stop Chinese laborers from coming through Mexico, especially into California. They used to recruit for employers. The U.S. Border Patrol used to recruit. I've got recruiting posters, copies of recruiting posters that they used to have. So there was a big buildup of Mexican workers, and they set up their own communities, then they moved into cities and all the way to Chicago and New York and St. Louis and all over the place, Kansas City, Omaha, Nebraska. Okay, and then the Great Depression hit, and then they started the repatriation campaign, which technically is not repatriation. It was deportation. You know, you can't be repatriated. And that's not definition of repatriation. But they were forced out. They were loaded on buses. They were forcefully removed. The one during the Great Depression was informal but very effective. The second cycle started with World War II. Again, massive, massive migration to the United States. A lot of times they went back. I've actually heard stories where they went back and moved into the homes that their parents had been in during the first in-migration, and set up communities again, and, you know, set up schools again and everything else. And that lasted all the way through the end of World War II, and then through the Korean War. It wasn't until 1954 that the second purge, it's more of a purge than anything else, was started, and it was called Operation Wetback. And it was run by a general who changed the Border Patrol. This time it was a military operation, and he re-outfitted the Border Patrol with military weapons and military cars and green uniforms. And Operation Wetback, again, split families and communities and forced people back across the border. In fact, it was scandalous because Mexicans were being transported, for example, deeper into Mexico to make sure that they wouldn't come back. For example, some Mexican workers tried were being shipped out of Port Isabel, Texas, and Corpus Christi, Texas, back to Veracruz, so they'd be so far away they couldn't get back. And these were in charter ships. And in one incident, several other men jumped overboard and tried to swim back and drown. And there was an international incident about that. And they had to stop doing that. But they were flying them back, you know, to Puebla and even deeper south into Mexico.
You write that you don't think that there's going to be a deportation campaign for the 12 million that are in the country right now. Why do you say that?
In the first place, they're so deeply ingrained into the economy. The economy is dependent on them. That's one thing. And that's why Bush is pushing so hard to get a guest worker program and to get some kind of amnesty for these workers. The other thing is the people themselves, the immigrants, know what's at stake and know what the issues are. And one of the most amazing things that I've seen was on April 10th, I went to the demonstrations and walked with the people and wore white and talked with them and tried to communicate with them the best I could. Also on May 1st, we had several hundred thousand in Houston. That's not what the press reported. People coming out. These are people who try to stay invisible because they're, you know, they're undocumented aliens in the United States. They live invisible. Came out demanding justice. Brought their families with them, proudly brought their families with them. I don't think these people are going to run the way they did before. In Operation Wetback, most of the deportees were rounded up in rural areas because they lived in what were called Mexican towns, which were usually settlements on a central farm or a central ranch where all the farmers would let the Mexicans live. And they were easy targets and they were easy to find. You know, they didn't even have transportation. You know, now you have immigrants whose children are going to college or going to high school. They buy cars. They buy houses. They've got equity in homes. There's been, you know, some fuss about that, but they pay their bills, right? And that's a lot different when the stakes are that high. The stakes are a lot higher than they are before. And as far as I can tell, these people understand the services that they're providing to the United States, and they're not demanding anything except recognition for what they're doing and credit for what they're doing. I don't think they're going to go all that easily. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to be intimidated that easily, and they have resources to fight this.
Do you think it's possible to manage Mexican immigration through a guest worker program?
No.
And why not?
The Bracero program was an attempt to manage farm laborers, okay? And like I said, they were brought across the border in El Paso, and they were taken to Fabens, and they were ID'd, and they were documented, and they were put in sheep dip, literally, you know, deloused, etc. They were under guard all the time. Then they were sent out. The Texas Rangers knew to watch these people. Also in New Mexico, same thing. And in Arizona, same thing. And Southern California, same thing. I'm just talking Texas because that's where I am and that's where most of my documentation comes from. Vigilantes watched them. The white citizens' councils kept an eye on them. Laws were passed about curfew laws where they couldn't be out at night and everything. So, but still, there were working men and women, mostly men with the Bracero program. They were allowed legally to bring their families, but most of them chose not to, because you wouldn't want your family living like this anyhow. You know, we had apartheid in the South and in the Southwest for Mexicans that looked like apartheid for the blacks. It was just as bad, you know, separate but unequal facilities and everything. But yet these were working men, and working men all know that the key to survival is getting as much as you can for your labor. You know, if you're going to be a field hand, you're good for a couple of years before you're trashed out, and then you're going to be sent back to Mexico. But if you can get to a city and you can learn how to drive a truck and you can get a driver's license, or you can learn to be a mechanic, or you're a welder or a sandblaster, or you see what I'm saying?
But you don't think that it's a bureaucratic nightmare? Because that's the only criticism I've heard of the guest worker program, that you couldn't manage it because you can't manage the small guest worker programs we have now efficiently. That's the only criticism that I've heard of the guest worker program. You're saying that it's because there's inherent discrimination in it that's intolerable?
No, I'm saying that it doesn't work because the guest workers are going to get out of the program as soon as they can also and move on to something better as soon as they can. If they sign a contract to cut grass at your house, as soon as they can double their salary, which they can do easily if you're making $10 a day, they're going to do it. I mean, it's the nature of working people to get as much as they can for what they do. So they can enter the country as under one pretext, you know, but then, you know, this is why they say all the guest worker programs, they say, everybody says this, you know, don't kid yourself, all guest worker programs have turned out to be permanent. And that's actually true, because they get out of the system and then they get some resources and, you know, they don't end up going back. You got to look at it from the worker's side of the picture, okay? This means that I can be exploited until you're through with me and then you're going to send me back to poverty in this country I came from? Well, you know, people are going to find a way around that if they can.
What do you constitute as a just solution to this problem?
Well, it's happening in the European Union right now, and nobody seems to be paying any attention to it. The mainstream media don't want to deal with it either, and that's open borders. If the goods can pass through on free market theory, you know, and international borders don't matter for manufactured goods, you know, why should workers be stopped at the border? Why shouldn't workers be able to follow the jobs? The European Union has just taken down most of the last quotas and opened the borders to workers. If you actually go to a border town like Nuevo Laredo, which you don't want to go to the Mexican side because they're having so much trouble over there, or El Paso, if you go to Laredo, for example, there's four train tracks coming across. There's three bridges. Two of them are commercial traffic only. And you can see the lines of trucks and you can see the goods flowing through. It's a veritable river of goods. If you go to the pedestrian area, you see the people stopped standing, you know, 16 wide and 3 miles deep, being checked and ID'd, and now they have the thumb computer program and stuff, right? Open borders. It's working in Europe. In effect, we almost have open borders in the United States with this gatekeeper, you know, mentality that goes on at the border right now. I mean, that's what I would say, because personally, I'm a working class person, always have been, and I think that the people who do the work of society should have the right to be compensated for what they do. All my relatives were from Ireland. They were white servants from Ireland, indentured servants, and German political refugees. And they had the right to go back to Germany and Ireland if they wanted to, or become citizens in the United States. It's not that shocking an idea, right? I mean, if you had a situation like that, people would pay their taxes, people would, you know, and they would also be entitled to protection from the government, earn the right to vote, or be a guest worker and return back if they wanted to. I can't see, with the globalization of the world and the European Union doing that, the only reason that the idea is being fought are the people who want to exploit labor on the basis of nationality, and I'm not going to side with those people under any circumstances.
But there's always also the fact that that would mean more social services that need to be provided to a larger immigrant community.
I mean, none of us are getting social services. I mean, they still have social services in Chicago. Have you seen the contraction of social services that's taken place in the past 20 years? If mm-hmm. you go back to the contract with America that was published by the Republican Party, they said, we're going to write a new contract with America, and it's going to be privatization, and you're going to get what you're entitled to buy, including education, and that's exactly what they pulled off. My concern is, you know, in the United States, if we have a free and open America that tries to meet the needs of its citizens, we have one thing, and I think we're at a turning point right now, or we can have a closed society that militarizes its borders with an increasingly rigid enforced social structure inside the country. Which one do you want? And you have to put the immigration issue in that context. And you have to put the issue of undocumented immigrants, and especially from a labor point of view, into that formula and look at it and say, which way do you want to go?
In your piece, Stolen Birthright, you have an interesting sort of thesis that this Mexican immigration has basically taken on a life of its own, that for instance, like in 2050, even if nothing changes, Mexican Americans or Mexicans in the United States, their population will be the highest minority in the country. So what do you think that this means for the future of the country?
I'm not sure that anybody's policy or any clever law that anybody's can write is going to change this tide of history that's underway. I make a comment that some people have taken me to task force, and I say that in Stolen Birthright that every man, woman, and child who migrates from Mexico to the U.S. is reclaiming a small portion of the birthright that was stolen from their ancestors by military conquest. I actually say that. And I didn't write that sentence. That sentence wrote itself. I had no idea how I was going to finish that, you know, following these trends that I was doing. And I wrote it, and I looked at it, and I said, oh, my goodness, you know, like, where'd that come from? And then after I went to the demonstrations on May 1st and April 10th, and saw the people and with their families, I think that's what's happening. It's kind of called the reconquest, and it drives conservatives, you know, into apoplectic fits down here, that the Mexicans are going to come back and take the territory that was originally stolen from them in 1848. I don't believe in cosmic cycles of history or anything like that, but the trends are just absolutely overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. What are your predictions about what legislation will pass?
They are going to pass something unenforceable because I think it's token legislation. I think they're going to send the National Guard to the border. My biggest fear is if we have an economic meltdown in the United States, we're going to have scapegoating, and it's going to be at undocumented immigrants, and we've seen it before. You know, I have a little bit of that history in that article that I wrote. And families were separated that never got back together again, and communities were devastated and everything. I think it could be worse this time because of the resolve. You know, I mean, are we going to have civil disturbances? You know, are we going to have military action inside the United States? Is America going to tolerate that? That's truly frightening. And quite honestly, if somebody came to my home to throw me out of my home and to put me on an airplane and fly me back to Guadalajara or take me to the border and dump me and pull my kids out of school and everything, I don't think I'd go peacefully. You know?
That was Richard Vogel, writer for the Monthly Review and author of Stolen Birthright, The U.S. Conquest and Exploitation of the Mexican People, found on the web at www.houstonculture.org. And you can find his newest article at mrzine.org. Coming up next, longtime civil rights lawyer and president of the National Lawyers Guild, Michael Avery, spoke April 28th in Chicago at DePaul University. Here's what he had to say.
I want to start out talking a little bit about secret police. Secret police in every society that has had them have been an oppressive institution, an institution that takes on a life of its own and is not subject to any constitutional or democratic restraints. This was true of the Okhrana in Tsarist Russia. It was true of the NKVD. Shortly after the Russian Revolution. It was true of the KGB during the Stalinist period in the Soviet Union. It was true of the Stasi in East Germany. And it's certainly true of the CIA and the FBI today to the extent that those agencies operate like secret police. Secrecy on the part of government is one of the hallmarks of a national security state. And there's no question that the United States today is now moving faster and faster into becoming a national security state rather than a constitutional democracy. The key elements of a constitutional democracy that are protected by the Bill of Rights are free speech, the right to be free from arrest and search unless the government has probable cause to believe that you're guilty of a crime, the particularity requirement of the Fourth Amendment that says when the government's going to conduct a search, it has to be looking for something in particular, not just conducting a fishing expedition to see what it might turn up, and judicial review of executive department action. And all of these key elements of the Bill of Rights are threatened by the various programs that the administration has put in place since September 11th. Along with adopting racial profiling as our national policy in connection with rounding up and holding over 5,000 people of Arab or Muslim backgrounds after September 11th, along with running a roughshod over the rights of ordinary Americans in a variety of respects, the construction of a surveillance industrial complex in this country that is far beyond what any previous dictatorship could have dreamed of establishing is truly one of the landmark achievements, if you will, of the Bush administration. So let's talk a little bit in that connection about the lawsuit that we filed against President Bush. And I can't tell you what a pleasure it is, by the way, to draft a complaint that's going to be filed in federal court that the first defendant is George W. Bush. There was some discussion among the lawyers when we drafted this thing about whether to sue Bush or just to sue the NSA, and my position was, are you out of your mind? We're going to put this guy right there. And if I could have served the papers in person, that would have been my first choice. What are the issues in this case? There are plenty of people in the room. I mean, this is a great room because there's such a range in this room of age among the people who are here. It's fantastic. This is a little deviation from what I planned to say at this point in the speech, but I want to tell you, just so you have an idea what's coming down the pike. I'm 61 years old. I'll be 62 in December, and I've spent my whole life since I was an adult as a civil rights lawyer. And I've represented the Black Panthers, and I've represented the people involved in gay rights, and I've represented women's rights people, and I've done a lot of work in Puerto Rico on behalf of the independentistas. But I am a white, a male, a middle-class guy who was born in Chicago and grew up in Minneapolis, a Protestant, Ivy League education. I've never been a member, narrowly speaking, of any of the groups that I've represented in my life. But soon I'm going to be able to claim to be elderly. And then we are going to see a movement like this country has never seen before for seniors' rights. I'll tell you that. But going back to the lawsuit. There are plenty of people in the room who can remember, and even more who've read about, the time during the Korean War when Harry Truman, as president, seized the steel mills in the United States because there was a threatened labor dispute that he believed would have disrupted the production of steel and interfered with the United States' ability to make weapons that could be used in the Korean War. And that case went to the United States Supreme Court on the question of whether or not the president had what constitutional lawyers would call implied power to seize these steel mills. Why implied power? Because there's nothing in the Constitution that says that the president has the right to seize private property, even for national security reasons. And so the question was there something in the Constitution that gave the president other powers from which we might imply, infer, he might imply, that that he has the power to seize the steel mills. And, of course, the favorite candidate for this kind of implied power is always the president's authority as commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And that case went to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court said, no, he doesn't have that power. He doesn't have that power in part because Congress made it very clear when they were considering the Taft-Hartley Act, which passed in 1948, I believe, that they weren't going to give the president that power. There was an amendment on the floor that would have given the president that power, and it was rejected. And so the Supreme Court said if the president doesn't have the power under the Constitution and Congress hasn't passed a law giving him the power and Congress has made it clear that he doesn't have the power, then in a very famous opinion by Justice Jackson on the United States Supreme Court, he said the president's power is at its lowest ebb in that situation. The dispute about whether President Bush has the power to engage in electronic surveillance without a warrant is a dispute, at least so far as it's a constitutional law dispute, about how it fits into this framework that the court established in connection with Truman's seizure of the steel mills. And a little history at this point is important. In the 70s, President Nixon also asserted a power to engage in electronic surveillance without warrants. And he was surveilling people who were deemed to be, by him, domestic threats to national security. And that case went to the United States Supreme Court. It's called United States versus United States District Court. We usually call it the Keith case because the judge was Damon Keith, who still is a judge in Detroit, Michigan, federal judge in Detroit, Michigan. And that case was argued in the Supreme Court by Professor Arthur Kanoy from Rutgers Law School. Arthur Kanoy was and will always be one of the icons of the National Lawyers Guild, and that was a case in which the National Lawyers Guild, as well as the National Lawyers Guild, was very much involved in that case. And the United States Supreme Court decided in the Keith case that President Nixon did not have the power, implied power, to conduct electronic surveillance without warrants of domestic so-called threats to national security. But that left open the question, actually, of what power the president might have if there were foreign threats to national security, foreign organizations. And the Supreme Court explicitly, in the Keith case, did not rule on that. Now, it just so happened that during this time, there was a committee meeting in the United States Senate, the Church Committee. And the Church Committee was considering evidence of the abuses of constitutional rights and civil liberties by the Nixon administration, specifically including illegal wiretapping and the infiltration of domestic political groups through undercover agents and spies and provocateurs. And the Church Committee, in a series of reports that run, if I'm not mistaken, 38 volumes in the Federal Register, documented an outrageous series of violations of rights by the Nixon administration. So in 1978, the Church Committee, having issued its report about illegal electronic surveillance and other illegal surveillance of domestic political groups, and this issue about foreign agents being left open in the Keith case, the Congress decided to act. And they passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which specifically allowed the president to engage in surveillance of foreign threats. At that time, they were mostly concerned about the Soviet Union, of foreign threats to our national security. But the law provided that the president had to get a warrant. And in order to make it as easy as possible to get these warrants, they set up a special court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Now, it's not a court in any ordinary sense. It doesn't meet in a courthouse. It meets on the sixth floor of the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. And the only lawyers who ever appear in front of it are government lawyers. defense lawyers never appear in front of it. And as a matter of fact, if you ever have a case, and I had such a case, at one point I was representing some Armenian Americans who were accused of conspiring to blow up the Turkish consulate in Philadelphia. Case was tried in Los Angeles. There had been one of these foreign intelligence surveillance warrants in the case. Even after they were arrested and even when they were being prosecuted, we didn't get to see what the government had relied on in order to secure that warrant. Only the judge looked at it. So they made it as easy as possible. The government didn't have to have probable cause to believe that people were committing a crime. They only had to have probable cause to believe that they were foreign agents. And as long as they had that, they could get a warrant to conduct electronic surveillance. Now, that was amended in later years so that it provide, and it was amended again after the Patriot Act, as a matter of fact, it was amended to provide that if the government was in a crisis situation and did not have time to go get a warrant before it was necessary to start listening to people planning some imminent threat against the United States, they could start listening first, even without a warrant, as long as they went and got a warrant within 72 hours. Three full days to go get the warrant after you start listening. And in this law, Congress said, this is the exclusive means by which the United States government can engage in electronic surveillance of foreign groups that allegedly pose a national security threat to the United States. And just to make the point even clearer, they said if any government officials do this any other way, it's a 5-year felony. That law only applies to government officials. If you and I did any national security wiretapping, we wouldn't be subject to that law. We'd be subject to a host of other criminal laws, but not that one. That one just applies to government officials. So one of the things that we claim in our case is that it's even much clearer now than it was in the Steele seizure case that Congress had said to the president, you can't do this unless you do it through the avenue that we've provided. The president has committed a felony under our law. Not once, but several times. He admits that he's authorized this program 40 times, and he's probably authorized it some more times since he made that admission. Each one of which, actually, each time they listen to somebody, it's a separate felony. He could be in prison not only for the rest of his own life, but for the rest of the lives of all the little shrubs that are going to come after him through his children and his grandchildren. That's how many felonies this man has committed. He should be impeached. There's no question about that. The President of the United States is not only a liar, he's a felon. And so we sued him. Now what's going to happen in this case? This is not going to be an easy case for us. Because the first thing the government's going to do, they probably did it today, because I think they had to file their papers by today, although I haven't seen any papers yet today. First thing they're going to do is come to court and say, you can't even hear this case. Because to talk about this program, we would have to reveal secret information. And that would compromise national security. And so you're going to have to throw the case out of court. That's going to be the government's argument. That secrecy requires that Americans not even have a chance to challenge the fact that their president is violating the law and violating the Constitution every time he conducts one of these electronic surveillances. Courts shouldn't even hear about it. So what are we seeing here? We're seeing violations of three of the four principles that I said were cardinal principles. Here is a search, because listening to somebody's conversation is a search. Here's a search without probable cause. Here's a violation of the particularity requirement, because they're just listening to everything they want to listen to instead of searching for something in particular. And there's no judicial review if the government wins this argument. Executive department gets to do what it wants without judges getting involved. And what the government is currently arguing goes a step further than that, by the way. There's this doctrine of the unitary executive. I don't know how many of you have heard about this or read about this, or how many of the law students in the room have studied this in law school, but there's this doctrine that President Bush is promoting called the unitary executive. Those of us who are critical of what they're doing call it the imperial presidency. That's what Al Gore called it recently in a speech that he gave. What does it mean, the unitary executive? It's a doctrine that says the whole executive department is a single whole, and the president is the boss of the whole executive department. What that means is that there are no independent federal regulatory agencies. I mean, our country has relied for several years on the existence of independent federal regulatory agencies to monitor and regulate excesses not only on the part of government but on the part of the private sector. Under this doctrine, the president could fire anybody who works for the executive department. That's not, however, the principal problem with the doctrine. The principal problem with the doctrine is a doctrine called coordinate construction. It has been the case since 1803. The law students know what 1803 was. That's when Marbury versus Madison was decided in the United States Supreme Court. It has been the case since 1803 when John Marshall declared, "It is emphatically the role of the United States Supreme Court to declare what the law is." It has been the law that the Supreme Court has the responsibility of reviewing from a constitutional standpoint both what the legislature does and what the executive branch does. Judicial review. And really, the buck stops with the Supreme Court. Lately, the president, and not just President Bush, by the way, this goes back. Clinton was pushing this line. Papa Bush was pushing this line. Reagan was pushing this line, that each branch of the government, the judicial, the executive, and the legislature, has its own responsibility to interpret the Constitution. Well, in a certain sense, that's true. I mean, if you work for the government in any respect, you have to take an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. But they mean much more than that. They mean that the president makes his own decision about whether something is constitutional and is not bound by what the Supreme Court says about it. So when President Bush signs these laws now and does one of these signing statements, presidential signing statements. Now, by the way, he did not invent these presidential signing statements. They began during the presidency of James Monroe. But between James Monroe and the end of the Carter administration, these signing statements had been used about 95 times. Between the end of the Carter administration and the end of the Clinton administration, they'd been used another 175 times. Bush, in his first term alone, had 475 signing statements. And in these signing statements, he purports to reserve his power to disobey the law he's signing if he thinks it's essential from a constitutional or national security point of view. So when we just had the McCain Amendment passed by Congress that said we can't torture prisoners. And by the way, if you have any doubt at all in your mind about whether torture has become the official policy of the United States government, if you're thinking this was just a few rogue soldiers in Abu Ghraib who were doing this on their own, go to the website of Salon.com. About a month ago, they posted 297 photos from Abu Ghraib. Now, this is not easy to look at. This is and a videotape, by the way. This is not easy to look at, but if you look at those 297 photos, you can have no doubt about the fact that the commanding officers had to know what was going on, and we know that from a variety of other sources now as well. Torture, notwithstanding what the president says, is the official policy of the United States. You have a case going on in Chicago now where Mohammed Salah, who was imprisoned in Israel after having been so-called interrogated, really tortured, for 80 days by the Israeli security forces, served a sentence over there of 4 years, and then was released, came back to the United States, and then was indicted here, and is now on trial in Chicago. His lawyers, who are some lawyers, guild lawyers from Chicago, Michael Deutsch and Erica Townsend, are representing him, and they're trying to suppress any statements that he made under torture, which, of course, he made just so they would stop torturing him. By the way, they were using forms of torture that had already been declared illegal by the Israeli Supreme Court. Now they're trying to suppress that confession in a trial here. And when it's time for the judge to make a ruling about whether they can ask these Israeli security officers questions, guess who's in the room? Not just the FBI, the Israelis. The representatives of Israel, who are arguing not our constitutional standards, but their national security concerns in a trial going on in our courts. So there's just no question that torture is the official policy. So the McCain bill, when Bush signed the McCain bill, or the McCain amendment, which would have made torture illegal, he signed one of these presidential signing statements, which said that he's going to interpret the law in the light of the doctrine of the unitary executive and his own constitutional responsibilities to protect the national security of the United States. In other words, he's only going to follow it when he wants to. And 2 weeks after that, he signed another bill which would have required our intelligence agencies to report to Congress, to file regular reports to Congress about how they're exercising the special powers they've been granted under the Patriot Act and various executive orders. He issued one of these signing statements then, saying that he wouldn't file the reports if he thought it would, under his constitutional authority, if he thought it would compromise national security. So the president is now exercising with these signing statements a kind of line item veto to disregard certain aspects of litigation as he sees fit. And there are constitutional scholars, Federalist Society sorts of people, who are writing law reviews to justify this on an intellectual level. So it's quite possible that if we were able to bring this national security wiretap case to court and win it, and eventually the Supreme Court were to tell George W. Bush that you can't engage in warrantless electronic surveillance, that based on this doctrine of the unitary executive and coordinate construction of constitutional principles, he could say, well, thank you very much. That's your opinion. But I have a different opinion, and I'm going to go with what I think I need to be doing. Now, as I say, that's an issue that we thought was resolved in 1803. But not according to the current brain trust, if that's the appropriate term, in the United States Department of Justice. Well, I could talk much longer about other provisions of the Patriot Act, the famous Section 215, getting a hold of what library books you're reading, the national security letters that the government sends out to get credit, and medical records and school records and other records regarding Americans without any requirement of a warrant. But I have found that extending that part of my remarks too long has a sort of an unfortunate, a debilitating and depressing impact on the audience. And I don't want to to leave you with that, because I want to address, at least for a few minutes, the question of what can be done. What can be done about this? And sometimes people ask that question as though finding the answer is difficult. And I don't think finding the answer is particularly difficult. I think the first thing we have to do, the essential thing we have to do, and probably most of the people in this room have already done this, but it's a question of instilling this among our fellow Americans, the essential thing we have to do is to stop acting and talking like we can go about business as usual until things get better. If that's our plan, things are not going to get better. Things are going to get worse. Much worse. Much worse. The people in power in Washington today are truly revolutionaries. And the scope of what they want to do defies the imagination. From everything from the tax code, where they would like to eliminate all taxes except those on earned income. I mean, an astonishing idea. To what they're doing with regard to civil liberties and prosecuting American foreign policy. We simply cannot sit around and wait until the Democrats come up with a better candidate. That's not, first of all, I don't think that's going to happen. And I have been going around the country urging people to adopt my position. This is not the official Lawyers Guild position, but this is my official position, which is I'm not voting for Hillary, and I'm not voting for John Kerry. I don't care if the Republicans find Hitler someplace and enliven him. I'm not and nominate him. I'm still not voting for Hillary, and I'm still not voting for John Kerry. I'm through with defensive voting. I think the whole time I've been voting, I've only voted for at most two or three people that I really, really, wanted to support. And the rest of the time I've been voting against people that we all thought would be worse than whoever the Democrats put up. But I'm stopping that, and I think that we need to serve notice to the Democrats that as long as they continue to behave like they are second-ring subs who play for the same team as the Republicans but are merely sitting on the bench waiting to get into the game when the Republicans make a mistake or get tired, we're not going to have change in this country. As long as both political parties aim their message at the 6% of Americans who are in the middle, we're not going to have change. As long as we continue to ignore the 40 to 50% of our people who are so disaffected, so alienated, so cynical, so left out, left behind and forgotten that they think it doesn't matter who's in power and so don't bother to vote at all, as long as we continue to ignore them, we're not going to have change. We have to demand change. I'm not voting for anybody for Congress. I live in Barney Frank's district. He's not bad. But I'm not voting for anybody for Congress who does not promise to support a bill of impeachment against George W. Bush if he's elected to Congress. Now, what has happened? There's a great book called No Greater Threat by C. William Michaels. It's about the Patriot Act, but it's also about the construction of national security states. And Michaels says national security states maintain their power by articulating a national mission and organizing the population around that mission. And our mission, according to the government, is the war on terror. Now, there's no doubt that international terrorism is a serious problem. There's no doubt that we were attacked on September 11th, that 3,500 people approximately were killed. And there's no doubt that there's some risk that there could be further attacks. But having acknowledged that, I have to say that in terms of the priorities of this country, the war on terror does not make my top 10 list of things we should be doing. And one of the things that's wrong with the political discourse and political dialogue in this country today is that not only are the Democrats not doing it, but we, the progressives, are not making enough noise about what the top priorities of our country are. The fact of the matter is, in terms of threat to life, domestic violence is a greater issue in this country than terrorist violence. The fact that we have 50 million people without health insurance is a greater threat to life. The fact that people are dying in this country of AIDS is a greater threat to life in this country. The fact that 40,000 women die every year from breast cancer, every year from breast cancer, is a greater threat. The fact that our educational system is going to hell in a handbasket is a greater problem. The fact that race is still a cancer in our society, which infects every aspect of life, particularly at this moment in time, the criminal justice system is a bigger problem. We have to begin making demands that the average American will support and that are important to us. Of course we should have a national health system. Of course we should have that. We should have a much better educational system than we have, where children are taught things that are important instead of simply how to pass an exam so that people can get a check mark on some stupid No Child Left Behind law that doesn't address the major problems in our country. We should have free public education all the way through college in this country. Other societies that have less resources than ours already have that. We should have family resources for families in this country that are meaningful. Most European industrial democracies have that. We don't. There's a long list of things that we should have. We should stop subsidizing automobile traffic and start subsidizing train travel and mass transit. Jane Jacobs died last week. And some of the newspapers said, oh, Jane Jacobs, who so heavily influenced urban planning. Too bad she didn't have influence on urban planning. We've known since Jane Jacobs wrote in the 1960s what we ought to be doing in connection with our urban societies. We haven't done any of it, or precious little of it. It's not rocket science to figure out what sort of demands are important to ordinary Americans. They have to do with housing and education and health care and security in your old age. And those are not on the platform in any significant way of the candidates standing for office in the United States today. And we have to demand that they become so. We have to demand that. I think 20 years from now, people are going to come and ask us. I hope I'm still around to be asked questions in 20 years. 20 years from now, people are going to come and ask us, what were you doing? What were you doing when Ashcroft and Gonzalez and Bush tore up the Bill of Rights and threw it in shreds at your feet? What were you doing when this cabal hijacked the Constitution and destroyed constitutional democracy in the United States and built a national security state? What were you doing? What were you thinking about during that period of time? And the answer that we were waiting for the Democrats to come up with a better candidate, that's not going to do it. We have to be able to say, we did everything we could. And as president of the National Lawyers Guild, addressing myself now to those of you in the room who are lawyers and law students, but not members of the National Lawyers Guild. I mean, this is a time, sometimes people say to me, why should I join the National Lawyers Guild? And my answer to that is simpler, to amplify your voice. This is a time when we need collective action more than we've ever needed before. To the lawyers and the law students in the room, I want you to be able to say 20 years from now, I joined the National Lawyers Guild, and we did everything we could, and you know what? We turned it around. We stopped them. We restored constitutional democracy in America. And then we began to build the kind of progressive, fair, equal justice society that we need. Thank you very much.
Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, speaking in Chicago on April 28th. From the Trenches was produced by Chicago's Independent Media Center at the studios of Loyola University. You can post your own stories or listen to this program again at our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Thanks to Indy Media reporter Chris Giovannis, and many thanks to WLUW for their continued support. Listen again on the last Monday in June for another report from the Trenches.